Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from London is David Hurst, the editor of Middle East Eye, who was formerly the chief foreign leader writer of The Guardian, former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow bureau chief, European correspondent and Ireland correspondent for The Guardian. And his latest article at Middle East Eye is Three Potential Motives Behind the Spat Between Qatar and Its Gulf Neighbors. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Hurst.
Hello. Hi. Thanks.
Well, thanks for joining us, David. And this is really, in effect, a blockade that's just happened. Things are moving pretty fast, as you point out in your article. But is this blockade of Qatar by its Arab neighbors intended to bring about regime change?
Well, that's what the Qataris fear. I mean, I think the word spat, which is the word I originally used a few days ago, is slightly inappropriate. It's much more serious now. I think the thing was pre-planned. I think the people who engineered this thought about this and laid plans for this for at least before the visit by Donald Trump to Riyadh, but that was like the sort of green light. I think what's happened is that over a long period of time, Qatar has been on the opposite side of both the Saudis and the Emiratis in a number of proxy local conflicts. In Libya, they were backing different sides. Egypt, they were backing different sides. One backed the popularly elected president, Mohamed Morsi, and the other side backed really a military coup against him. And so it's gone on in one conflict after another. And I think what happened was that the Emiratis finally got fed up and decided to really go for the kill and basically either force Qatar to back down and change its foreign policy or force some form of regime change. And the level of rhetoric that is normally employed in these disputes is of a sort of different level. They were actually saying they were physically threatening the Emir of Qatar and calling him basically the source of instability in the region, which is quite a heavy thing to say to basically a GCC member. Also, I think we've got to realize that this puts America in a very difficult position, because in each of these small statelets, there are very, very important American bases with thousands of troops. So another way of describing this conflict is that the hosts of a very important CIA drone base, which is in Saudi Arabia, and the hosts of an extremely important air base in the Emirates, is laying siege to the hosts of CENTCOM, which is where, well, the forward base of CENTCOM, a huge complex south of Doha. And it's more and more like the sort of plot of Catch-22. It doesn't make any logic from, you know, these are all three of these states are very important American military allies.
So in the broader context, though, surely there is this new de facto alliance, if you will, between Israel, Egypt under the military dictatorship, and the Saudi royal families. And how much is, since this seems to be more than a subtext to crush Hamas, or at least defund it, what do you think is, you mentioned this was all triggered by Trump's recent trip to Saudi Arabia. So the plan's in play. What is the plan?
That is certainly one of the subplots. Hamas has recently had an election, and Khaled Meshaal, who still is based in Doha, has given his position to now his successor, who's based in Gaza. So in theory, both the external and the internal leadership of Hamas is based in Gaza, so it shouldn't really affect them. But in practice, Khaled Meshaal is still a member of the Shura, of the council, the governing council of Hamas. He still has a role to play. And so, de facto, Doha are still housing Hamas, or at least Khaled Meshaal. And this will have an effect. Their funding, mainly from Iran, was cut off after the events in Syria, which, as you know, they fell out with their former hosts, Bashar al-Assad. And they had to move office, or Khaled Meshaal had to move office from Damascus to Doha. There are reports that some members of the organization are now moving from Doha to Turkey and to Lebanon. and we'll see what happens. But certainly one of the subtexts of this is Israel pressurizing the external leadership of Hamas by supporting and by having all sorts of under-table conversations with the Emiratis.
But let's then try and go further, if you will, to find out what Israel's motives are here. We know that the Egyptian military government hates the Muslim Brotherhood, and Hamas is a protege of the Muslim Brotherhood. That's all pretty clear. If the arrangement that between Trump, the Saudi monarchs, al-Sisi, General al-Sisi, and Netanyahu is somehow to squeeze Hamas, is this based upon this chimeric idea that if you can get rid of Hamas, somehow you can make a peace deal with Abbas, what's left of the Palestinians, this man who appears to have little to no following?
Yeah, well, it's a little bit more complicated, unfortunately, because this group of Arab states and Israel have another idea entirely, and that's to replace Abbas, who's actually pretty inconvenient for them, with Mohammed al-Dahlan, who is a protege who's based in the Emirates. And that's been a long-standing plan. So that if you look at this, all of these maneuvers from the point of view of a very aging and stubborn Palestinian president who refuses to go away and whose term of office has long since expired, it's a threat to him as well, this alliance, because they are actually backing a guy that he's now fallen out with. So it's almost, if you're looking at this in terms of Palestinian politics, a three-way split between Hamas, Dahlan, and Mahmoud Abbas, and they're all vying. In fact, Hamas is in fact in that triangular relationship, Hamas is less of a problem than Dahlan is. On the ground in Palestine, there are fights going on between supporters of Mahmoud Abbas and Dahlan in Balata refugee camp. So there's actual physical clashes on the ground because of that political rivalry. I think in the broad context of things, here we are on the 50th anniversary of the start of the Six-Day War in June 1967. Literally, this is the 50th. Today, June the 5th, is the 50th anniversary. Then you had a large measure of Arab unity in fighting Israel and trying to get rid of it, of the occupation. And of course, they were very quickly defeated. Now what you've got are the same Arab states consorting with Israel and coordinating with Israel, even though they don't formally recognize the state of Israel, to do something very, very different. In Netanyahu's hands, I think this is good news, because he doesn't really have to do anything. He doesn't have to advance the peace process. So certainly nothing like what was suggested to him, i.e. a Palestinian state on 1967 borders. And he's more than happy that if he decides to launch an attack against Gaza or launch an attack against Hezbollah, which would be probably a more obvious target for him now because it's a proxy of Iran, he would have the backing, the tacit backing, of the Emiratis and the Saudis and the Jordanians. And that's the situation we find ourselves in. So it's not a question of a plan that would impose a new Palestinian leadership or a plan to impose some form of solution, a grand bargain on the situation. It's more, in Netanyahu's mind, a plan to continue the status quo, which is basically occupation, a deepening occupation, and a deepening control of the West Bank. The entire narrative in Israel and the push amongst the right wing of his cabinet, which is more and more powerful both in politically and also in the army as well, is for annexation. They're not talking about a Palestinian state. In Netanyahu's hands, all of these developments are a bit of a godsend. It means he doesn't really have to do that much.
So does that mean then that Netanyahu's sort of toying with Trump and letting him have his little fantasy about being a peacemaker?
Ultimately, yes. I don't think really the Trump administration is in any shape to do the enormous amount of shuttle diplomacy involved. that Clinton, both Clintons did, that Kerry did, to fine-tune some form of agreement. I'd be very surprised if any substantial agreement came out of this at all. This is an administration that, as we'll see later on this week, is in profound trouble at home. And I simply don't think it's either got the expertise or the energy to engineer some sort of grand bargain in the Middle East. I think what this would, the only thing that they're really thinking of is, or certainly Netanyahu is thinking of, is having things carry on as they are. There isn't a new peace process that's about to flourish, and certainly not in these conditions where you have Abbas fundamentally undercut both by Israel and by the Arab states. I mean, if you go back in time and you think of who engineered a reconciliation between Hamas and Fatah, it was something called the Mecca Agreement, and the Mecca Agreement's in Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis were neutral. The Saudis now are not neutral, at least in the hands of Mohammed bin Salman, the deputy crown prince. I think there's one rider that I would add to all of these comments, and that is that when we talk about Saudi Arabia, we're not really talking about the entire royal family. We're talking about one faction of the royal family. There's another faction which is under the crown prince, who is a guy called Mohammed bin Nayef, who supports Qatar and supports Turkey and supports doesn't support the Brotherhood, but is much more pragmatic about political Islam. He doesn't consider it terrorists. He doesn't consider them terrorists. At the moment, he's staying absolutely silent. And I think there's an internal facet to this. If Mohammed bin Salman wins this and manages to subdue in some way or change the foreign policy of Qatar or even engineer a coup and turn it into a sort of Bahrain, a sort of satellite of Saudi Arabia, then he'll be in absolutely pole position to sort of basically take over the throne when the father goes. So I think there's a bit of internal jostling going on in all of this. But this is a very, very high-stakes game, and what we're seeing is a real conflict involving real people, which could still have really big consequences. It's become much more than a diplomatic spat.
Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation with David Hurst. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation with David Hurst, the editor of Middle East Eye, where he has his latest article, Three Potential Motives Behind the Spat Between Qatar and Its Gulf Neighbors. So in terms of the dynamics, and I think all the Saudis, princes and the king, the one thing they have in common, even though Nayef is more pragmatic on political Islam, the animus towards the Muslim Brotherhood, which the Al-Thanis in Qatar appear to support, and that seems to be, at least on the surface, a part of the rift, is just this reactionary medieval monarchy simply does not want any other form of government to take hold. And my understanding is that the Al-Thani family, basically, their argument is, well, look, the people, the public in the Middle East support the Muslim Brotherhood, so we can't ignore it, and we can't certainly ignore it on Al Jazeera, which is another thing that irritates the Saudis. So Does that also logic extend to Hamas? I mean, Hamas is still popular. And it seems when you talk about making these deals and imposing a new Palestinian leader on the situation, it's all in the realm of political fantasy because there doesn't seem to be any regard for the street, what the public think.
And of course, that is absolutely the. You're quite right. This is that there's absolutely no wish to have genuine and popular Palestinian elections, so that the Palestinian, all the Palestinian structures, the PLO, the parliament, the PA, they're all hollowed out shells. They haven't had proper elections. They haven't been refreshed from the ground up. And it's in everyone's interest, well, certainly the people that we're talking about, not to have elections. I think you're completely right that really what we're talking about is payback time for the Arab Spring, and the absolute monarchs and the military dictators who are horrified at what happened in 2011 basically want to ensure that this never happens again. Turkey and Qatar supported the Arab Spring and supported the idea of democracy and free elections. They didn't mind, or they actively encouraged the Muslim Brotherhood, but there were differences there between the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas, and also differences between the Muslim Brotherhood and Turkey. In fact, if you remember, Erdogan turned up in Egypt when Morsi was still around and said they should have a secular constitution. So what we're seeing now is an attempt, and I think Trump gave the green, or the arrival of Trump gave the green light to this, to finish off the job. The job, from their point of view, I'm talking from the Emirates' point of view, is only half done. In fact, with all the billions that they poured into Egypt, Egypt is still unstable. Libya is a mess. Their man in Libya hasn't arrived in Tripoli yet. This is the renegade Libyan general Khalifa Haftar. Mm-hmm. And so they're looking at this now as a way of actually just finishing off the opposition, and one of the chief funders of the opposition. So you've got a really, apart from the issue of the Muslim Brotherhood, you've got a fundamental split in the Arab world, and one side basically now wants to sort of crush the sponsors of the other side.
But just in the last couple of minutes then, let's touch on the intramural palace intrigue within the context of everything that we've been talking about here in terms of the isolation of Qatar, the possibility of them blockading the country. They already are blockading it in terms of food and transportation and airline travel, etc. It does seem like the precursor for some attempt at regime change, and the excuses given about the Al-Thani family's affection for Iran seems to be pretty absurd. But when you talk about the palace intrigue with the boy king in Saudi Arabia, the crown prince who's gotten the country into this mess in Yemen, they don't even have a real army because the royals, again, are so afraid of anybody else that they break up the military into different, you know, the palace guards, the national guard, etc. And it seems like the boy king has got himself in a real bind there. And if Nayef is more pragmatic, can he wait this out, or is the kid going to fall under his own weight and under his own hubris?
It's an extremely good question, and I really don't know the answer to that. Nayef has been very, very silent, right? But that's most crown princes are silent. Salman was silent when Abdullah was pursuing a different policy. So the fact he's silent doesn't mean he's lost power. He could simply be biding his time. And it has to be remembered that bin Nayef still remains interior minister. And that means, exactly as you said, it means he's in charge of one of the three big military forces that run Saudi Arabia. So much so that people who actually have been invited on a visa by the boy king, by bin Salman, have had the unpleasant experience of being stopped by the border police controlled by bin Nayef and being questioned. It's just a sort of little sign, a little game that one side of the royal family plays with another, just to remind people who's in charge of what. And it's a pretty odd experience when you're being invited by someone who you think is very powerful suddenly to be questioned and treated like treated with suspicion in Riyadh airport. But that's, there are cases of that happening. I think that bin Salman is acting with a huge amount of speed and recklessness. He, if you look at his, just the range of his portfolios, they are in charge. He's in charge of a very big and ambitious program of privatization, and that is going to annoy quite a few people. In fact, it already has. He will have to demand more taxes, that VAT, that will annoy the Saudis. Saudi, unlike Qatar, Saudi has got quite a high unofficial unemployment rate, and wealth is not spread. And Qataris per capita as citizens are much wealthier than the Saudis. So there are inherent problems in Saudi Arabia, and I'm not sure that bin Salman has got the wherewithal, or indeed the people he needs around him, simply to handle the sheer number of portfolios that he is has taken on. He's taken on control of this privatization program, which is really a first in Saudi's history. He is Minister of Defense. He's launched a bombing campaign in Yemen that 2 years on has still failed to dislodge the Houthis from Sana'a. He's fallen out with bin Zayed over Yemen, over the south of Yemen.
Bin Zayed being the head of the AEU, right?
Who controls Aden Airport. So in Yemen, you've got one side of this triumvirate fighting against another. Saudi Arabia is still backing the old president Hadi, and Hadi has fallen out with Mohammed bin Zayed. So this alliance isn't that stable. Again, Egypt and Saudi Arabia have kissed and made up recently, but it's got to be remembered there was a major fallout over the sale of two uninhabited Egyptian islands to Saudi Arabia. And at the time, they blamed the Muslim Brotherhood media. But in fact, it wasn't the Muslim Brotherhood that kicked up over this. It was the Nasserites. It was nationalist Egypt. So just because they have combined and are now laying siege to Qatar doesn't mean that alliance is that stable. So we have a period of intense instability now in the Gulf states. Everyone is quite rich. They're highly armed. They've got they're all governing proxies all over and proxy conflicts all over North Africa and the Levant. And I think the next few days will be absolutely critical for the region. I think the one thing we haven't talked about and the thing we should really concentrate on is what will Turkey's reaction be, because Qatar has got a few cards to play. One of them is America, and signs from the White House that they won't change the military balance. So Qatar desperately wants to keep on to this base that they've got as an insurance policy. Iran is another card they could play, but I don't think that is a particularly useful one for them. Simply because of the sheer number of other complications involved in Iran. But the real card to play is Turkey. Turkey has a military alliance with Qatar, and I would imagine Turkey is now pondering whether to back Qatar or to leave it alone. And that's going to be an absolutely critical next phase of this conflict.
Well, I keep saying in the last minute here, but just a very quick comment, if you will, before we close, because clearly our audience will be interested in what's happening in the UK since Saturday's horrendous terrorist act on the London Bridge and nearby pubs. My understanding is that this very sensitive government report into terror funding in the UK, which allegedly focuses on the role of Saudi Arabia, is being suppressed by Prime Minister Theresa May. Of course, she was, prior to becoming Prime Minister, she was Home Secretary with jurisdiction over these things. And both the leader of the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats are calling for the release of this Home Office inquiry because people clearly recognise that at the end of the day, terrorist attacks have to be dealt with at the ideological level, and clearly the Saudi Wahhabi ideology is all over this attack, as it is all over all of the previous attacks in Europe.
Yes, this is the ultimate irony of the Saudis accusing the Qataris of basically funding terrorism, and that is that the Saudis have been up to their ears in plots at all levels, level of private individuals and also the level of governments in funding groups of jihadis in Syria, in Lebanon, all over the Arab world. And of course there are links with 9/11, and you know, you remember the suppressed 28 pages, and there are also certainly links in London. This is a problem for Theresa May because, as you said, She'd been Home Secretary, so this was, all of this was under her watch. She can't say this was Cameron's government. She was actually in charge of the security. And the real truth is, it's completely out of anyone's control. This is a repeat of a very, very similar and tragic story, which is all behind the 15 years of the so-called war on terror, that the guys that you promote one day for various foreign escapades come back and turn into something completely different, you know, 15 years later. In the Manchester bombing case, these were guys who were sent out, some of them under control orders, to Libya to topple Gaddafi. They come back, and some of them become jihadis. And in this case, you know, you have groups of jihadis who have definitely had, you know, connections all the way around the Gulf. So it's what the government, what May wants to do is say, enough is enough, I'm a tough leader, I'm going to deal with this. What she actually means is measures against the Muslim community in Britain that have absolutely nothing to do with tackling the jihadi problem. But I think the whole of Europe, not just Britain, is going to have a huge problem with the sheer number of combat-ready ISIS fighters who will be returning from Mosul and returning from Syria. This is unfortunately going to be a fact of life for decades to come.
Well, David Hurst, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Hurst, who's the editor of Middle East Eye and was formerly the chief foreign leader writer of The Guardian, former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow bureau chief and European correspondent and Ireland correspondent for The Guardian. And his latest article at the Middle East Eye is Three Potential Motives Behind the Spat Between Qatar and Its Gulf Neighbours. And again, I'm Ian Masters, and this has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.